This is Celtic Connections with Cathy Sinnott. Celtic Connections, the show with the Catholic view of what's happening right now in Great Britain, in Ireland, and across Europe. Celtic Connections with Cathy Sinnott. Broadcasting from Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Celtic Connections. I'm Cathy Sinnott and I'm coming to you from Cork in Ireland. St. Oliver Plunkett is a name well known to the Irish. Along with Patrick, Columba and Bridget, he stands among the greatest of Irish saints. Oliver Plunkett was Archbishop of Armagh and therefore he was a direct successor of St. Patrick himself. And as with so many Irish of his day, he paid the ultimate price for his faith when he was martyred at Tyburn, London on July 1st, 1681. Today, we will hear his remarkable story, a story which will bring us from Rome to Ireland and even to Argentina. And to tell his story, we have Sister Veronica Rafferty, a Dominican sister of Our Lady of the Rosary and St. Catherine of Siena. And Sister's community is in Argentina. So we begin with some context. It was the 17th century, and Catholic Ireland was suffering great persecution under the English Parliament. Oliver Cromwell was a key figure sent by Parliament to subdue the Irish. Here's Sister Veronica with Paul Macquarie to take up the story.
His mission was to eradicate Catholicism. And at the same time, he was doing it with armies and killing people, killing thousands of Irish men and women.
So these really were the persecutions in Ireland.
Well, it was like a tide that came in and out.
That's right. Like
Elizabeth was not that kindly towards Catholics either in England or in Ireland. And the plantation of Ulster was an attempt to have people, Protestant, who would be loyal to the crown. So Catholics would have been seen as against the crown, anti-crown,
right.
Really. And then when Oliver, he picked up that anti-Catholic bias.
Yeah, and really we weren't, the penal laws then, Catholics weren't allowed to celebrate Mass.
They weren't allowed practically to do anything.
To do
they
anything,
couldn't
and there was
pass
laws
on
prohibiting.
Land to their children. They couldn't send have schools for their children. They couldn't send their children abroad to be educated. They couldn't own a horse that was worth more than £5. And, every single aspect of life was legislated for.
That's right.
And it was all to deprive them and keep them in poverty.
Yes, and priests and religious were outlawed.
And priests were expelled and they were hunted down and there was a prize for if you brought in a priest. Or killed a priest.
That's right. Yeah. So in the midst of all of this was Oliver Plunkett.
So Oliver came into a very aristocratic family. He wouldn't have been among the best off parts of the family, but he was certainly very well connected to Sir This and Lord That and Baron and so forth. And on both sides of his family, both his mother was Dillon and his father was John Plunkett. And he was born there in Loch Crewe in County Meath. And the ruins of his home are still there. He would have lived in a stone medieval tower was their residence. And then they had a chapel adjoining it where local people would have worshipped. And very, very Catholic. His uncle was the man who educated him between the age of 6 and 16. Because there were no schools for Catholics, his uncle was a priest, a Cistercian, Patrick Plunkett, and he brought him to his parish. I presume he lived with him while he was a parish priest and educated him until he was 16. When a group, himself and four other companions, were brought to Rome to do their seminary studies when he decided to, he wanted to be a priest.
And this was all in secret at the time?
Well, it was all, yes, it was a... They set out for Rome, 16, he would have been 16, so add 16, 1641, they would have headed for Rome. And they were, of course, they were pursued actually by pirates. And whether they felt and knew that there were Irish men on board and that they were heading for Rome and they wanted to intercept them, we don't really know. Or maybe they were just going to capture them anyway. But
so he went
at that
went
time.
There,
it all everything had to be secret. Everything had to be in hiding. And
So he had his formation as a priest in Rome.
In Rome, yes, and he was an outstanding student. He did two doctorates, and he ended up being a professor in propaganda fide. So he was there for 22 years in all. That was the main part of his life. He only had 10 years of ministry when he came back to Ireland.
Okay. Yeah. So was he intending all of that time to come back to Ireland?
Yes, they had to make a promise, these young men who went over there as seminarians, that they would come back to work in Ireland. They had to do that in writing. But because the persecution was so terrible just in that period, they didn't want to risk their lives. So they stayed. He and his friend John Brennan stayed on. They both were professors in the college.
Okay. Yeah. So he came to Ireland when?
So then he came back to Ireland in 1671. He died 1681. Mm-hmm. So we'll give you that 10-year thing. And sure. He had quite a difficult time getting back as well.
So he came back as a priest?
He came back as Archbishop
is
of Armagh
right?
Primate of all
That's
Ireland.
Extraordinary.
Yes, a sudden shift, total shift of gear.
So all of that happened in Rome?
So that was all arranged in Rome. The Pope himself stepped in when they were debating who they would appoint when a man called O'Reilly had died abroad. There had been no resident bishops for so long. Yeah. The church was in total chaos.
Sure.
And the clergy were absolutely, corrupt. And undisciplined, like there was just no leadership at all.
The clergy
and they had to get a strong
Ireland.
Man. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. Then
meanwhile, the ordinary people, that weren't converting in large part to become Anglican, so that they could get this advantage and that. They kept the faith.
Kept the faith in poverty and in
that's right.
Total disarray. They had only the rosary to pray, and they had they had mass rocks when they could. They were. In a very, very few churches, because all the churches that had existed were given to Protestants, and the Catholics had to pay actually to support the minister as well as to support any priest. So it was such an extreme set of laws.
That's right. And the Mass Rock, coming back to the Mass Rock, is that's when they were able to come together and celebrate Mass.
Yes.
In secret. And we have so many stories of heroic. Priests and lay people and martyrs during that time.
Exactly. I suppose persecution has that effect. I hear of Vietnam, and there are 1,000 young Dominican sisters there, and their grandparents were martyrs, and they say that's the reason that they have the vocation is so is
blood
so
of the
strong.
Martyrs.
Yeah,
yes.
Blood of martyrs.
Seed of the church.
Absolutely, yeah.
This is Celtic Connections. You're listening to the story of Ireland's saint and martyr, Oliver Plunkett, as recounted by Sister Veronica Rafferty, Dominican Sister of Our Lady of the Rosary and St. Catherine of Siena.
So enter Oliver Plunkett. How old was he then when he came to Ireland as Archbishop?
Well, he died at 56, so he was 46.
So it was quite a long time in Rome.
He was 22 years in Rome. He loved Rome, and he did the seven churches, that pilgrimage of the seven churches. He visited Spirito Santo, a hospital for the poor. So he was well known as a kindly pastoral, even though he was a professor and an academic. But he had all this side to him as well. He was really very much admired and respected.
So it must have been extraordinary coming to Ireland at that time, and obviously disguised as a lay person, I presume. And
he was he took on the disguise of a British Army captain.
Really?
He had a wig and a pistol and a uniform, and he called himself Captain William Brown.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
They think that there's a man called Howard, who was a Dominican and a priest in England, in London, got him the uniform to get him safely over to Ireland and in, you see.
So what did he do when he came?
Well, he just threw himself into confirming people and going round and visiting. He had to visit everywhere because there were
Because he couldn't preach openly.
He couldn't preach openly, Well, there were about 3 years when there was a milder version, when there was a more friendly viceroy in Dublin, and he wasn't all that harsh in applying the laws.
Okay.
So it loosened up a bit, so he could go round. He actually set up schools, had the Jesuits come to Drogheda and set up a school for educating young people, and there were a lot of Protestants cousins went to the school as well, so they were glad to get good education.
Wow.
And then it were also in, he had in mind, like, for the priesthood as well, because the priests...
The authorities kind of have a blind eye to some of the stuff going
on.
They
let that all happen.
Yeah.
Then another change of viceroy and back the game and closed the schools. And and he had huge debts as a result of that. You know, he'd built these places up. He was always asking for money from Rome.
And then he was on the run again.
And then he was on the run again. So all the bishops were expelled and all priests were expelled. And he and John Brennan decided to stay. I put that in as the title of the little biography I wrote in Spanish about him. He chose to stay with his people.
Wow.
He chose to stay with me, even though he knew it meant certain death.
Yes.
And
he was used to this wonderful cultural capital of the world, Rome at the time, and all the comforts and everything else. And there he was, an Irishman, choosing to come back.
Yes, and living, there's an oak tree down near Ardpatrick where he is often spent the night and hid from the soldiers.
My own. Oh my.
And still that oak tree is revered there as Oliver's tree.
And was he all over Ireland?
He went up as far as Donegal. Mm-hmm. Because there was a real rascal in as the Vicar General of Derry, Terence O'Kelly. He was just so bad. He brought everybody to civil court, sued them if they tried to demote him. But anyway, Oliver was a very clever guy and he had it all fixed up and he was friendly with the lords and so on of Ulster. So he, when this came to his time to deal with Mr. Terence O'Kelly, he managed to get him out of that.
Yeah.
So he would have travelled up around the area of Derry Donegal, because the part of Donegal is part of the Derry Diocese.
Yeah.
He certainly was over there, but he went all round the north.
Yeah. Was he actually sort of based in Armagh at any stage?
Well, I would say he didn't spend... No, he spent a lot of time in the village of Louth, because Lord Louth was a relative, and he gave him a house to stay in, and that's where the oak tree is in the grounds of that house. And then he had a little, tiny little chapel up on the hill, Ardpatrick it's called, and he had another one in Ballybrack.
Sure.
But apart from that, it was mass rocks and caves and under trees, and his whole worship and liturgy was all out there.
Extraordinary, and he would have been at the mass rocks and... saying mass and everything. So tell us the fruit of his ministry. You were talking about the confirmations.
Yes.
Do we know much about
he registered. I mean, he was an absolutely prolific letter writer, and he wrote reports.
And we have those
reports,
letters,
reports, and they're all there. They're in Downside Abbey in England, actually.
Okay.
That's another story, how the Benedictines got into this. But... at least 50,000 people he had confirmed in the first few years, and he was indefatigable. He had four horses, and they were always on the go. He had a servant called James McKenna, who these relatives paid for to look after him, look after the horses, and bring his post. And you know, he was writing all the time.
Sure. Didn't he ordain a lot of priests?
He ordained a lot of priests in Ballybrack or Ballybarrick. He ordained a lot of priests there, and that was what was amazing. It amazed him too, like the faith of the people, that these young men wanted to be priests, and they knew it meant almost certain death.
Yeah.
And certainly it meant poverty and, you know, discomfort of all kinds and hardship, you know.
So eventually the British authorities caught up with them. What happened? How did that happen?
Well, they had a lot of help from a few renegade priests that he had...
Is that right?
That he had excommunicated. They were... I'm sorry to mention, but there were a few Franciscans among them. I have a sister, Franciscan.
Yeah. Why did he excommunicate the priests at the time? Do we know?
Yeah. Well, the bad behavior. They were robbers. They were violent. They were did women and families. They were just not.
So he came
living
to clean
up
out
to
the
it
Irish
at
church at the time.
He came over to sort things out.
Yeah, yeah. And they weren't pleased.
They'd gone to the dogs, as I said, at that level. And he tried. He had synods. He held synods right away, and gathered them and put down regulations. A bit like the Council of Trent did for the generality of the Catholic Church. And at the time, and he straightened things up. And people, of course, were delighted. The majority were delighted, but some were not delighted. So these were the ones that denounced him for treason, that he was organizing an army against Charles II was in at this stage, he was planning an attack on the king, and the Titus Oates plot, which was, of course, totally false, that the Catholics were planning to kill the king and all the rest of it. So these two, these guys, these gentlemen, whatever, they're all named. They're all named. It's all registered. He knew exactly who they were.
Yeah.
And they gave false witness. They said that he had an army, that he was collecting money from the priests to finance his army and all that kind of stuff. Well, they held a trial, first trial was held in Dundalk. And, of course, nobody there would believe a word of what they were saying.
Yeah.
Number one, they turned up drunk anyway, and to give their yeah. story, tell their story against him, and it was just, you know,
sure.
dismissed, case dismissed. But then they tried again in London, said if we can have him tried in London, we can get rid of him.
Wow.
So it was actually his own who turned against him. It wasn't
my,
the British, but they were delighted.
And you know, so many parallels with our Lord in that sense. Betrayed
yeah.
and then false witnesses.
He was really betrayed, he really was. Mm-hmm. And then for the second trial, which was held, and he was martyred on the 1st of July, well, about 15 days before.
He was taken to London and then...
And he was, for about 6 months, he was in Newgate prison.
Yes.
And
he was still able to write, isn't that right?
He kept writing,
right up to the end.
Right up to the
end. And didn't he write to his brother just the day before he died?
Yes, and send messages to his nieces and nephews.
Yeah, because I read an account where he wrote to his brother and said, well, tomorrow I'm going to be martyred
mm-hmm.
and my innards will be held in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'm completely at peace.
Peace, yes. Yes.
It was an extraordinary peace,
yeah.
and he knew it was coming from his heart.
That's right. He said, I think the Lord has given me this grace, because he couldn't believe himself how at peace he was. His hand, when he signed, he made his will, and when he signed it, his hand wasn't trembling or anything, you know.
It's extraordinary.
He left £10 to James McKenna, he left £5 to somebody, £1 to somebody else, in gratitude for their services.
Yeah.
And he didn't tremble.
Isn't that remarkable?
He said it was a special grace the Lord gave
yeah.
him.
And you said at the beginning, sister, he knew that this was going to, likely going to be his fate
mm-hmm.
at the end.
Mm-hmm. He knew it from the day he left
yeah.
Rome.
So he'd run the race,
yeah.
you know.
Yes.
Extraordinary. So
yes.
what happened then?
Well, I always say, and this man, Tommy Burns, who has written the biography, he agrees. He did, his martyrdom was during those 10 years. The actual death was nothing. It was over in a second. He actually died when he was hung, because he used to have it partially hung, and then while he was still alive,
yeah,
you know,
that's right.
all the rest of it.
And
horrible.
He thought this was.
But he died, and so his death was just like a split second, whereas those 10 years were a real martyrdom. He worked so hard. He travelled
yeah.
so much. He had all these people against him.
Yeah.
All these.
And it's incredible, sister, when you say he came really to bring the gospel to his own Irish native people, but also to clean out the church as such,
mm-hmm.
but not in some sort of comfortable administrative way, you know,
right.
sleeping under trees
yes.
and on the
yeah.
run and
yeah.
all of these things and
yeah. uh-huh.
and then excommunicating these priests and then betraying them. I mean, it's incredible drama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but as you say, such courage.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
Well, I think he was a man of a fiery temperament. He was a strong character.
Is that right?
And he came of this lineage where they were used to, you know, having servants and, you know,
yeah.
bossing people around. So
sure.
there was he had a strong ability in him to face a conflict and deal with this. But I can't understand how he dealt with the hardship. They said his health was broken.
Is that
anyway,
right?
He was a very, looked an old man.
So that
he
was
only
56.
Well. He looked an old man when he was in prison because
wow.
he was worn out. He was,
wow.
you know, cold
wow.
and hunger. And
yeah.
he said at one stage himself and John Brennan said, we'd have given anything for a piece of oaten bread, which was the bread of the poor, you know.
Yes.
We'd have given anything for a piece of oaten bread.
Yeah, yeah. Often I think that the faith that we have, the privilege of having the faith now, rests on the people like Oliver Plunkett
mm-hmm.
and our forefathers, our foreparents,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, stayed with the faith,
mm-hmm.
you know, through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And we take it so for granted now,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just let it go
yes.
so easily.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
What day and year was he martyred?
1681, the 1st of July. So the 1st of July has been always celebrated as his feast day.
Certainly. And he was martyred where?
He was brought from Newgate Prison. He was attended his last days by Father Corker, a Benedictine, whom he made executor of his will to look after his body, his letters, his whatever he had, and to pay these men who had helped him. He was dragged through the streets. That was the way they did. They had a horse, and then they had a kind of a wooden slats.
Yeah.
And he was lying down on his back on that and dragged through. And, of course, the crowds were jeering so on. That was part of the spectacle.
Yeah, but
there are paintings of that. And but, in fact, the days before, he had so many visitors. He was worn out. People wanted to come and get his blessing. People had heard of his holiness. People had heard, knew he was innocent.
Yeah.
And even the prison guards said, you know, gave testimony that he had been so gentle and he spent his time praying and fasting and so on.
Wow.
And so they gave testimony that he was a saint.
And these prison guards who weren't even Catholic?
No. So they gave testimony of that. And then when he was brought to Tyburn and... he made his speech. He spent a lot of time preparing his speech from the scaffold.
Yes.
And he named his people who denounced him.
Wow.
And he stated one by each thing, I wasn't there, I wasn't at that place, I didn't do this.
Because he was accused of treason.
Accused of raising an army. He was accused, and he said, I was somewhere else at that. You say I was there in such a date, holding some kind of a meeting. So,
it's a kangaroo court, really.
And he forgave all his enemies. Of course, the end of the speech was very, very like St. Stephen. It was very like our Lord, you know. Don't hold this against him. He forgave his execution. He prayed for me. He prayed for everybody. And it must have been stunning to be there and to hear that man just ready. And he gave it without trembling, without a
Tell us about the aftermath of his execution, of his martyrdom. Because he was the last Irish martyr, am I right?
Mm-hmm. Well, he had appealed to Charles II, of course, who was a very oscillating kind of character. He'd be pro-Catholic one day and next, and he actually died a Catholic. So, so he would say, oh, give him a favour, pardon him, and then not pardon. He didn't want to fall out with the Parliament because they had executed his forebear. Charles I lost his head. So he was always fearful of that, and he wanted to keep in with Parliament, which were still very anti-Catholic. So after he died, then Father Corker, who was a Benedictine, got permission to they took the head immediately. James McKenna threw it into fire, so it's actually burnt.
Yes,
and that head is perfectly preserved today. The tissue in it is still as it was.
That's right, and it's preserved in St. Peter's in Drogheda. You can go in there into the church.
You can go in and see it,
and you can see it. You know, go right up to his face. It's incredible.
Yeah. So it was brought first of all to Rome. And then to the Irish College in Rome. And then when Catherine Plunkett, who would have probably was a grandniece of Oliver Plunkett, she was a Dominican nun, when she came to set up the community in Siena Drogheda, it was sent over for safekeeping to their convent. They kept it until 1920 when he was beatified. And when they requested that, that it would be put in a public place.
Yeah.
So they seated, not apparently without some resistance.
Sure.
They were sorry to part with. But the whole question of his remains, Father Corker was made abbot of Lambspring in Germany because the English Benedictines were persecuted as well as the Irish. They suffered too and had to go into exile. So they got a convent or an abbey in Germany, in Lambspring, in the diocese of Hildesheim. And they kept, he came back 2 years later to the cemetery in London, got the rest of his bones and brought them over there. Then when Napoleon comes on the scene, around the 1800s, he was confiscating monasteries and whatever, and they were afraid these relics would disappear. So they brought them over to Downside in England. So now there's a big shrine in Downside in England.
Wow.
And Father Corker, they brought back the letters, they brought all that he, being the executor of his will, had in his possession. It all landed in Downside. So when canonization, beatification, all these big moments appeared, they distributed relics to Old Castle in County Meath, which would have been his parish church, to the sisters. Instead of the head, they got a rib and so on. So the whole thing of how his remains have been preserved, it's amazing too.
Yeah, it's beautiful, people, the devotion to the faith and the sense of a martyr.
Yeah.
You know, that all of these things were so diligent, how that all happened, you know.
This is Celtic Connections. You're listening to the story of Ireland's saint and martyr, Oliver Plunkett, as recounted by Sister Veronica Rafferty, Dominican sister of Our Lady of the Rosary and St. Catherine of Siena.
Let's go forward a few years, and you become a religious sister with the Dominican Sisters of Our Lady in the Rosary and St. Catherine of Siena. And then you become a missionary out in Argentina, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Our story of Oliver Plunkett and the story that brought you here today continues when you went to South America, because you then encountered, tell me about this encounter with this gentleman in South America.
Yes, at one of the, I think it was the centenary of the setting up of that association in Rosario. So I'm at an event there, because being one of the few Irish-born people in Rosario, they have included me in all the invitations.
Yeah.
So I was invited there, and I met this gentleman called Rodolfo Plunkett.
Rodolfo Plunkett.
Rodolfo Plunkett, right.
Of all names.
So he starts telling me how the Plunketts landed in Argentina, and how his aunt had given him this holy picture with St. Oliver's portrait on it. And it was the year of the beatification. They had held some big ceremony, a mass or something, publicly, and brought out a whole lot of these little memorial cards of his beatification. So I was fascinated by this. And then he invited me to his house. He lives in Rosario, only a few blocks from my home.
It turns out he's a relative of Oliver Plunkett.
Oh, yes. And the family have kept that link.
Did he look Irish?
Yes, he looked Irish, yeah. Blue eyes.
And tell me when his family arrived in Argentina.
He tells it with great gusto. In 1840, John Plunkett, who would have been his great-grandfather, set sail from Ireland to go to Canada with his family. So he was pretty well off, because he had a sailing boat capable of crossing the Atlantic at that time. And then they apparently didn't settle in Canada. They decided he would head south to warmer climes, to Buenos Aires.
A bit of a jaunt.
Right. When he got to Buenos Aires, because he was English-speaking and so on, he became friendly with the then president. It's called Rosas, Juan Manuel Rosas. And they used to play cards with him and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, then President Rosas and asked him to do him a favour. There was a French blockade on. The French and the English were always trying to take over Argentina, you see. They got rid of the Spaniards, and then these others came in. And so there was an English boat way out on the sea, and he wanted some documents brought out to them, but passed the French blockade. So he said, would you mind in your boat? They won't think you're anything to do with armed forces or navy or whatever. So he said, I will. And he did. And delivered the letters safely. And then he came in to Bahia Blanca, which was much further south, because the storm had blown them all off course and they were much further south. And when he came into Bahia Blanca, he orders a horse and he rides as fast as he can up to Buenos Aires to tell the president that he had done the job and that he had delivered the documents. And he said, well, what can I do for you? So he said, well, I'd like some land around Bahia Blanca. I like the look of...
Wow.
Literally means White Bay.
Yeah.
And so they got land there. And he settled there, and he became the mayor within 16 years of settling there. Mm-hmm. And so he's a direct descendant of that John Plunkett.
Extraordinary. And I'm sure he's a very proud man to
have
that.
He is very proud of it.
His lineage was, if the word is right, pure, in the sense of he was Caucasian, he was Irish. He looks Irish now.
Yes, he looks
Irish. Does he speak English?
He does speak some English. He's with lack of practice, I think he's lost a lot of it, because he worked for an American firm, the Esso Company. He worked in that for a number of years.
And he's a family man. He's what age is he?
He's late 70s, 78 now.
So being a proud son of Oliver Plunkett, he then did some paintings?
Well, he always kept this holy picture in his wallet, he said, all the years an old aunt had given to him. And he felt that it was a protection. And in 2006, he likes to paint, and his mother was a painter. He has a lot of her paintings up in the house. He decided he would paint a portrait from the holy picture. And it's quite a large one, and he had it up in his home.
Okay.
And he used to pray, and he got into the habit of, talking everything over with Oliver. He tells me, Oliver told me to do this. Oliver told me to do that every day. Every day is another story. Well, when in 2006 he got it blessed, he gathered the Argentine community there, the Irish Argentines called, came into his house, these photographs of that. And then I come on the scene and I visit Lough Crew and I bring back photographs.
Now, what's Lough Crew?
Lough Crew is where Oliver was born.
In Ireland?
Yes.
And you took some photographs?
2015.
Well, that's quite an ancient settlement as well, isn't it?
It is. There are old pre-Christian tombs there. Yeah. Old pagan tombs. Mm-hmm. And
so you showed him these photographs and
he was
delighted.
I showed these photographs and he was so touched. So we got all enthused. Said, oh, we'll have to celebrate St. Oliver in the Irish chapel, in the St. Patrick's Chapel.
In Rosario.
So we talked to the committee and we talked to the priest and they were all ready. And the priest read up everything on the internet and he gave a sermon you would be proud of. He told the story of Oliver. Yeah. And after the Mass, he said to me, Sister, do you think you could get us a relic of St. Oliver? Well, I wondered, how could on earth would I ever
find a relic? 10,000 miles from home or whatever it is.
Exactly, and having just come and got a new interest in Oliver. And I started writing to people here at home, sisters, and they said, well, actually, our congregation has a very important relic handed down from Bishop John Brennan.
Your own congregation?
My own congregation, right there in Cabra. So I got out to the archivists and they said, well, you know, in 2014 we didn't know what to do with this relic. And we decided to give it to the sisters in Siena and Drogheda, a contemplative community, because they have always been associated with Oliver and they've had his head there for so long and so on and so forth. Well, I write then to the prioress of Siena Convent Drogheda. And, well, it was quite a delay in answering because they were changing priors and all that. Eventually, I resent the letter and, hey presto, of course you can have the relic.
My sister, this is a very substantial relic. What is it?
This is a relic of left elbow of Oliver, which was given to his best friend and colleague for all the years in his young men in Rome and professors and so forth, and who shared his work in Ireland, who decided to stay with the people when all the bishops were expelled. John Brennan, with one N, by the way, it's one N, John Brennan. And this is John Brennan's relic. Wow. He had it in his possession, and it was he became Archbishop of Cashel, and that eventually came into the possession of Bishop Moran, who gave it to the sisters in Cabra. I think the link is that he had some relation there in the community.
Okay.
I still have to find that one out.
Okay.
But I got this relic. Well, they were so thrilled. So how to get it to Argentina? I wasn't going to be back in time for the 1st of July. So it had to be somebody else. So I got Sister Dorothy, who spent some time in Argentina, one of my contemporaries. And she was delighted. She drove up to Drogheda. She got the relic. And when a man from Rosario and his daughter were in Dublin, the night before they left for Argentina, she brought it into them in the hotel. And she has a photograph of three of them in the box. Now, you wondered, how would you get that through customs?
Of course.
Well, the man who was doing it is an accountant. He was very, very fussy. And he wanted letters from the Archbishop of Rosario. He wanted letters from the priors of Siena. He wanted all kinds of documents authenticating what this was, that it wasn't anything to do with drugs or a bomb or anything like that. And so he didn't actually have any trouble, customs.
Really?
No, he didn't.
Well, it's interesting because I suppose Argentina being a Catholic country, maybe the people would be somewhat familiar.
Maybe at airports.
If you were bringing it into Heathrow, it might be a whole different matter.
Yes, right. Well,
a piece of someone's elbow. Explain that.
How did they install it? It was a cold, wet, rainy night like Ireland on the 1st of July in Argentina last year. And they wrapped the box up in a tricolour.
And an Irish flag.
Rodolfo and his wife carried it up the steps towards the church. The chaplain was there standing waiting for this and he opened it up very, very reverently. And they had a bagpiper piping. You know,
wonderful.
Emotional tune. It was a big moment. And then a big banner up. Welcome, St. Oliver, the saint of peace.
El Santo de la Paz.
Because
he's patron of
peace and reconciliation in Ireland. Yeah. And so that was quite a moment. I'm sorry I wasn't there for it. But Sister Susie recorded it for me in a short video. So I have sent that around. Yeah.
How beautiful.
Yeah. So that is how the relic got there.
Yes.
And the link with Ireland and Argentina is this relic was stored in private homes or in the bishop's palace or wherever.
Yeah. And if it wasn't in Argentina.
And now it's publicly venerated.
Yeah, if it wasn't in Argentina, it could be maybe in, you know, somebody's desk or drawer or something.
Yes.
Because there's so many relics I suppose, in Drogheda. Of course, the head's in Drogheda.
Yeah.
That's beautiful story.
So, Rodolfo then got a whole, we got 5,000 holy pictures with his portrait on it.
Yes, and tell us about
that. And a prayer at the back for peace.
Yeah.
He's distributing those day in, day out.
He's found his mission. People are coming
back to him saying, oh, this is a very miraculous saint. He's got me this favour. He's got me that favour. He's given him to the Chinese in the supermarket. And he's it's become like a mission for him.
You told me earlier he painted an image of Oliver Plunkett, right?
He did.
Is this the one that's on this prayer card or is it a different one?
This one that's on the prayer card.
I'm looking at it now, sister, and my goodness, it's the very distinctive features of Oliver Plunkett. He's the long hair and the beard, and he's very strong features, Oliver Plunkett, that we're used to.
It's very, very white. Some of the more artistic members of the community said, why don't you give him a little more colour? He looks like a ghost.
He's got piercing eyes.
But it's interesting that most of the portraits have this kind of whitish on the forehead.
Yes.
It's quite a common feature of a lot of the portraits that are on internet.
Yeah, and they're almost like photographs, you know, those images. Mm-hmm. So so all of this connection, you know, with your community, and you're in South America, it's amazing, and and we were talking earlier, and Oliver Plunkett, as Catholics, we grew up, we knew about Oliver Plunkett and a little bit of his story, but it wasn't like this, you know, forefront in our minds. But when you recap the story, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and when you relate it to persecution of Christians,
you
know, in Egypt, Iraq, and wherever in the world now, it's just so relevant.
That's right.
That is someone as brave as that. I mean, I often think, gosh, I'm such a coward when I compare myself to somebody like that, who faced into all those difficulties. And we've threatened him. I mean, one Franciscan sent a man to murder him one time, you know, at the point of a sword. And just because there was someone else in the house, he didn't do it. And so on. He really suffered martyrdom during those 10 years. And knew he was going to die, knew that would be the end.
Yeah.
So it is very relevant nowadays, both for the peace process. And that's the other part, I think.
Now, let's get on to that, because this is very interesting, because we're in Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Yes.
And Northern Ireland would have been really kind of an international scandal in Christendom for 30 years, because everybody knew Catholics and Protestants apparently were killing one another in Northern Ireland. And so many people here were praying for peace for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And so pick up the story there with regard to Oliver Plunkett, patron saint of peace and reconciliation in Ireland.
Yes, well, if you think of the two years in the 20th century associated with his beatification, 1920, when Ireland and politics in Ireland and the
beatified. So he was beatified in 1920.
And I think that was quite
a turbulent time in Ireland.
Turbulent time. And I think the peace treaty was signed on the 1st of July. 21.
A peace treaty in
in between England and Ireland that settled
in
that.
1st of July 1921. Yes. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then you come to 1975, which were the height of the Troubles years, we call them the Troubles.
Worst years of the Troubles.
Yes. Right. It started 69, late 60s, and with Bloody Sunday in Derry and all that had happened. And bombings I remember coming home and you just turned on the wireless.
Terrible sectarianism.
And it was bombed last night in such a place and so on.
Yeah.
So the fact that that was, resuscitated, as it were, the witness of Oliver in 1975.
The year of the canonization.
Year he was canonized. Okay. And there's a wonderful miracle associated with that. But Paul VI named him then patron of peace and reconciliation in Ireland in 1975.
Wow.
Right. So the Troubles went on and on and on into the 90s, and they were struggling to find, to get a peace process. And this group of people in Dundalk decided to set up a prayer campaign for peace. They started in 1997. And in 1998, the Good Friday Agreement was signed. And again, it was the 1st of July when they sat down for the first time, Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness.
And we should tell people
table.
So Ian Paisley were arch, and Martin McGuinness were arch enemies.
Arch enemies.
Yes.
So that some of
Catholic
that,
and Protestant.
Yeah. So to invoke Oliver into Irish history again, as obviously it's always related to finding peace or way forward and the breaking of the pike, you know.
Yes, because part of the peace process was a decommissioning of arms.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. Yeah. And of course, in all of this, we're talking about this strife. It's not just Catholic and Protestant, you know, it's not even
it's
Catholic and Protestant.
It's political strife, yes.
It's political, you know, between Britain and Ireland and sovereignty of Northern Ireland, loyalty to the crown.
Yeah.
Or loyalty to an Irish republic, and our ancestors' ancestors, whether it be Catholic or Protestant, or one side or other of this argument. And Oliver Plunkett, of course, martyred in the midst of this historic feud.
And his, because of his family connections and because of his nature, he was able to bridge, even in his own lifetime, Protestant and Catholics in Ulster. He was friendly with them all.
Wow.
He had that ability.
Yeah.
And he didn't want people to be lining up and taking sides and saying, you're the enemy.
Yes.
You know. And it's like what Clinton said at Martin McGuinness's funeral. He expanded the sense of us.
Yes.
And reduced the sense of them.
Yes. Right? A peacemaker.
So there were less and less people who were
he
way
paid
over there.
The ultimate
and the
price.
Yeah.
And even his
jailers
saw that
even
this man was a saint.
Saw,
It's extraordinary, isn't it, sister?
Did.
You couldn't make it up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been an extraordinary journey you've taken us on, sister.
Yeah.
So what's next for Oliver Plunkett? And
well, Rodolfo had various ideas before I left.
Yeah.
And I have not been able to get in contact to see what he's brought them for. Of course, he would like, you see, this to build up every year.
Yeah.
Something more.
Yeah.
The weather didn't permit any kind of a procession that day. But, you know, it's quite a common thing to have. To remind in Argentina, they'll have a procession at the drop of a hat, you know. I'm sure if the weather's permitting, we'll have a walk around the block at least.
Of course, of course.
Relic.
This is Celtic Connections. You're listening to the story of Ireland's saint and martyr, Oliver Plunkett, as recounted by Sister Veronica Rafferty, Dominican sister of Our Lady of the Rosary and St. Catherine of Siena.
Well, sister, you left Ireland in 1972, which was the worst year of the Troubles, by the way, in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people died that year. And we had Bloody Sunday, I think, that year and all of that. And you know, you grew up in Ireland and I presume like a Catholic family like ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you're coming back after, what, 44 years?
Mm-hmm.
Give us your sense of what you're coming back to in Ireland these days in this Catholic country.
Well, it's certainly very heartening to realise how far the peace process has gone forward and how many people participated in that. When I came home for a sabbatical year in 85, I went to Corrymeela quite a bit.
Which was a place known for reconciliation.
Presbyterian minister, Davy, Ray Davy, had an absolute insight into bringing people together.
Yeah.
If you meet as human beings. And, of course, at the root of it all is forgiveness. When we came to the end of our discussion down in St. Peter's, and the parish priest there said to me, you know, peace work, you know, in the end it's all about forgiveness.
Yes.
If there's not forgiveness, there's no letting go of what your ancestors did to my ancestors
in the
Dún. So you can go on at that forever. But it never ends until you can forgive. In other words, you just let it go and wipe it out.
Yeah.
And you live now. And you will together. And I was very pleased to hear that I went to a book launch by Sheila Katz, who has published a book on 100 years of working at peace building between Palestinians and Israeli. She's a Jewish lady. And we have a similar background in co-counseling. And she brought that to Jerusalem when she was a young woman in her 20s. And she has been at this work for 40 years. And she said she was brought over to Belfast by a friend of mine 40 years ago, and she went to Corrymeela. And she said, that started me off. That inspired me for my work when I went to Jerusalem. When I came home now, I always like to have a focus for whatever block of time I have, and it was always peace. And that's one of the things I want to relate this Oliver story to in Argentina, is work for peace.
Of course.
We have a peace program
And which is training people for peace, troubles.
training teachers, training people to reduce violence. The healing only takes place when each one tells their story and the other person can actually listen without showing anger and without getting... She said how many people in Jerusalem, she brought Palestinians and Israeli together, and she said it all went fine, each one was telling their story until one woman couldn't take it any longer, and she got up and shouted, "That's all lies, that's all propaganda, you want to destroy yourself," and so on. And then they listened to her, and eventually she came to tell how she had been expelled from Egypt as a child of 8 years of age and so on. And she could then eventually came to see what this Palestinian man, who had been expelled from his home back and so on, and they ended up being able to listen to each other and to realize that the suffering was the common factor.
Yeah.
And that if they could hear each other, get in there, and then forgive.
Sure.
That was the only way.
Well, it's interesting, sister, because, you know, I grew up in Northern Ireland and through all the troubles and all of that. And then I traveled, I was in North America for 2.5 years. And, you know, inevitably people say, "Oh, you're from Northern Ireland. Are you Catholic or Protestant?" And you talk about religion. And people say, "Oh no, I don't believe in God. Sure, look, they're killing one another in Northern Ireland." It was a scandal like that at the time. And it was very interesting what happened in Northern Ireland with the peace process. Because when there was the Good Friday Agreement, I remember very well, and the media and the BBC, everybody was focusing on, these people will never agree. To get, you know, the Catholics and Protestants together to actually agree a government, it's not going to happen. It's not going... And it did happen. Mm-hmm. It was quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Everybody was flabbergasted with the agreement at the time. Mm-hmm. And then some years later, then with the devolved government and the assembly, where we had, as you talked about, Ian Paisley, who was an absolute ogre to Catholics. Hated Catholics, it would seem, and represented everything that was prejudice and bigotry against Catholics, who wanted to destroy, you know, Sinn Féin, this political wing of the IRA, coming into government with this political wing of the IRA, Martin McGuinness, who was representing nationalists and very militant nationalists at the time. So they came into government together. And it was just remarkable, the whole peace process. That, and then, as you say, the arms were decommissioned and all of that. And we had a whole addressing of the imbalance of society, the, you know, the equality for Catholics and Protestants in all areas. Of, and the police and Catholics were joining the police and endorsed by nationalists and everything else. And then at the time, I remember there were so many groups, like you described in Drogheda, of people praying for peace. Catholics and Protestants and together. Like in Coromila. Like Mother Teresa, you know, visited Coromila and gave a series of talks years and years ago. And then it was in the news. There were these, when after the whatever the atrocity was. And I remember people like a gentleman called Gordon Wilson. Do you, I don't know if you remember
him.
It was during the Poppy Day bombing in Enniskillen. And the IRA had put this bomb with these people just commemorating the war dead. And under the rubble, he and his daughter were under the rubble, and she was, "Daddy, are you there on this?" And he's holding the hand, as I recall, of his daughter. "Are you all right, love?" "Oh, I'm okay, Daddy. I love you, Daddy." And then she would scream, or, and then she died. She was a young nurse. And then the next day or two on the television, Gordon Wilson, a Protestant, a Christian man, said, came on and he said, "This is terrible what's happened to our family. I forgive those people who did that." And then the story of another, a friend of mine, Bernadette Power, Catholic from West Belfast, was either coming from Mass or a prayer meeting. Their car was hijacked or whatever by loyalists. And her husband was shot dead beside her in the car, with the children in the back. She has the Bible with his blood on it. She forgave the men who did that. And really what we have here is forgiveness. I think opening the grace, the heart of God, to give us the miracle that was peace in Northern Ireland. So the very thing that was these Catholics and Protestants scandal is now an occasion of peace because of that. And people like Ian Paisley, who's a baptized Christian, who, you know, has all kinds of issues with Catholicism, had a measure of Damascus moment conversion politically, And I remember he talks about his wife and everything. Should I do this? And he gives this incredible speech at the time when they went into government. For our children, we need to do this. And that's the miracle. So the architect of the troubles, you might say, Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness and the like, were the architects of the peace. You couldn't make it up. And of course, Martin McGuinness, who died recently, him and Ian Paisley became great friends.
Oh, absolutely. It's extraordinary. And his widow were there. She loved Martin McGuinness.
Yes.
Because they related as human beings, eventually became friendly.
That's right.
He loved their family.
And we've discovered since that Martin McGuinness had a measure of faith as well. And they would have had those conversations. No doubt me and Paisley would have brought up, you know, about Jesus Christ and salvation, you know. So it's an incredible story, Northern Ireland. And we remain with peace in Northern Ireland. I don't think anybody can imagine that it would go back to the battle. Now, we still have little elements of trouble here and there, but really it's a great witness to peace, and peace because we are a Christian society in Northern Ireland. Do you know? And ironically, too, in Northern Ireland, there's great trouble now because the imposition of abortion and the gender issues and all of this. And ironically, it's our Protestant friends in government in Northern Ireland who are holding back the defence of the unborn and women threatened with abortion, you know. So do you observe that coming back to Ireland?
The issues are so different, yes.
Yes.
No, and even the 2016 celebration, I've wondered what would come up with the 2016. What would it mean to this young generation? What would be their ideals? What cause would they find? And I was just reading in a paper that they had a debate in Cork on abortion, and that the people who were pro-life won hands down. You know,
thanks
be to God that they couldn't believe that. And now that's the generation who are studying now, and they were still able to listen to those arguments in favor of life and so on.
Yeah.
So I think there's a huge mix now. Number one, the many races in Ireland. When I left Ireland, it was, you know, all the one colour.
That's right, and their own religion.
Monochrome
as well.
Monochrome, but now it's polychrome. So that's in itself. I think the Polish people have brought a huge, commitment to faith
the
and
Catholic
practice
Poles.
Of faith.
Yeah,
Catholic Poles. Yeah,
and you know, I think we need to reawaken an appreciation of our faith with the likes of Oliver Plunkett. And Ireland, these that have been forgotten, the price that was paid, you know, by our ancestors, for us to have the privilege of the faith and the value of the faith. So often we forget, and the sort of radical secularism that's been imported to Ireland. And, you know, I don't know if you've listened to the radio, sister, but so often anything that's Catholic or Christian on the radio, there's some derogatory thing, you know, that's going on, which is very sad. So we need to remind, you know, people, you know, of this treasure that we have, you know. Sisters, tell us about this book. What's it called?
It's called Journey to Sainthood, Oliver Plunkett, and is written by Tommy Burns, who's a layman and Catholic, very active Catholic layman. There's a photograph of him at the back of the book. But he has made what I would call the definitive biography, because he has drawn, he's actually done a list of all those at the back who have written about Oliver. And it's 100 chapters in it, and you can open it anywhere and read it. It's so colloquial. It's not a literary gem by any means.
It's accessible to ordinary people.
Exceedingly entertaining to read. And He talks about the National Campaign for Prayer began in Drogheda in 1997.
So it recounts so much of what we've been talking about.
So, yes.
And where can people get this book?
It's selling in St. Peter's Church in Drogheda.
So
that's
if people Google St. Peter's Church in Drogheda, hopefully they'll find
it
out on the website.
And you can also get this prayer. He has prayer cards printed.
Okay.
And it's a very, I think,
well,
it's
we'll
worth
finish
reading.
With this prayer,
finish with
sister.
This prayer. Glorious Martyr St. Oliver, who willingly gave your life for your faith, help us also to be strong in faith. May we be loyal like you to the See of Peter. By your intercession and example, may all hatred and bitterness be banished from the hearts of Irish men and women. May the peace of Christ reign in our hearts, as it did in your heart, even at the moment of your death. Pray for us and for Ireland. Amen.
Amen. Sister Veronica Rafferty of the Dominican Sisters of Our Lady of the Rosary, and St. Catherine of Siena, thank you.
Welcome.
You have been listening to Celtic Connections with Cathy Simon. Join Cathy Sinnott next time for more Celtic Connections.